So we're Ecclesiastes chapter 1, 1 to 18 this morning, kind of doing the introduction to the book. As I was reflecting and as I've been studying the book of Ecclesiastes, there was a kind of a troubling truth that stood out to me. That as we look upon this world and all the things that this world promises, we can often do so. We can often look at this world with far too much optimism and hope. And I know if I examine my own life, there's been a number of occasions, a number of times, probably much more than I would care to admit, of where I have put too much optimism and too much hope in this world. And maybe that you could say the same of yourselves. And so in this series in the book of Ecclesiastes, we're going to take about 14 weeks to go through the book. We're not going to go through it every verse by verse. It's got 12 chapters. We're not going to go through every single thing in a lot of detail. But we're going to take 14 weeks between now and June or so to look over this book. And what we want to do is we're going to address the problems and provide a different viewpoint. We're going to address the problems that this world has, and we're going to provide a different viewpoint for them. We're going to do so from the way that Ecclesiastes does it. Now, I could be probably accused of being a pessimist. I'd like to believe myself to be a realist, but some would argue with me. So you might read the book of Ecclesiastes if you have never done so before. If you haven't, I'd encourage you to read through it. And what you're going to find is that it's quite dreary. It's quite dismal. It isn't very optimistic, it seems. And so that kind of feeds into my natural realism. But what is the wonderful thing about a book of the Bible, and as we study it, what we choose to do and what we should do is we need to approach the book the way the writer approached the book. We need to have the tone that the writer has. But I also don't want to leave you without hope and just leave you entirely pessimistic. I don't want you after 14 weeks to just go, man, every single Sunday I feel worse about myself than I did the Sunday before. We don't want anything like that. But we're going to see that through the study of this book, that we will find our fulfilling life. But it's going to be because we are despairing of this world. And so one of the main questions that we need to ask, some questions that we need to ask ourselves as we approach the book, and one of them is that why should we study the book of Ecclesiastes? Not just because it's in the Bible and so we should study it, but why particularly should we make the book of Ecclesiastes part of our study of scriptures? And Philip Ryken gives five different reasons why we should study the book of Ecclesiastes. The one that he says is that the book is honest about the troubles of life. Sometimes we get in this thing where people are not being upfront about what is life all about? Sometimes Christianity could be understood as, well, it's all going to be rosy and nice and good and life will be much better. But here is the reality that he's saying to us is that he's honest. He's honest about the troubles of life. Life is full of troubles. Anyone had any troubles in their life? We all have. And it's honest about them. Another reason that we should study this book is that Ecclesiastes tells us what happens if we choose what the world offers instead of what God gives. This world is constantly offering us things. We were talking about that just this morning as we were discussing a little bit about advertising on Facebook. It's always advertising. This world is always advertising things to us. And how do we live in a world that's constantly offering us things when we should be receiving what God gives? And this book helps us to see how to work that out. A third reason why we should read this book is because it asks the biggest and hardest questions that people still have today. One of the things that I hope will come out as we study this book is that you'll realize that the problems that we have today are really no different than the problems that they had 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. In some ways, they look a little differently in how they're the packaging that they're in, but the problems are still there. We still have the same questions about the same issues as they did then, as the author of Ecclesiastes did, and we have the same today. The fourth is this, is that Ecclesiastes points us to God as the only one in whom we should worship. In this world, a lot of divided attention that is given to many things. And each thing that draws our attention away from God is a form of worship of that which is not God. And this book helps us to point us back to whom we should worship. Also, it teaches us how to live for God and not just ourselves. The temptation that we often have as people is to live for what pleases us and what makes us happy and what fulfills our life rather than what is living for God. And this book helps us to understand that and to sort that out. So who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes? In Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1, if you look at that verse, it says that the writer of this book is the preacher. If you have a different version, it might use the word teacher. The Hebrew word for preacher is the word koholeth. So if you want to try to say that, your little bit of Hebrew that you learn, just put a little into it. Spit a lot. The more you spit, the probably closer you are to the proper pronunciation, but it's koholeth. And the word koholeth basically means the preacher, means the teacher. And the Greek word that we have that means the same thing is the word Ecclesiastes. So it's basically Ecclesiastes is the preacher. He is the one who is going to be teaching us, but it doesn't tell us who he is until he says that he is the son of David and the king of Jerusalem. Now, this has most often been associated with Solomon. This is the traditional authorship that is given for the book. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 16 and Ecclesiastes 12, 9 seem to point to that understanding that Solomon, who is king of Jerusalem, king of Israel, was the author of this book. Recently, in the years that have come since then, since some of the traditional authorship understanding, it's believed that this might be a fictional autobiography, that it's not actually written by Solomon, but it's written by someone who is writing as if they are Solomon. Now, I think the most natural way to read the book is that Solomon did write it. But perhaps if we entertain the idea for a moment that he did not, it doesn't change the fact that this book is the Word of God inspired by the Holy Spirit. And so Solomon is writing. He is called the preacher. He is Koholeth. And he is writing to us for a purpose. In chapter 1, verse 12, we find that Koholeth wanted to use his wisdom to see if there was anything of worth on this earth. And he kind of made himself an assignment, a project, if you would. He had a goal to see if with all of his wisdom, with all of his understanding, with all of his knowledge, if he could sort out what this world was all about and why we were on this earth and what we had to do with our lives and how we should live. He wanted to see if there was any value to all the things that we do. And he even looked at things that he calls madness and folly to see, was there any purpose in it all? Is there something that can be brought out of it that could be helpful? And he didn't withhold anything from himself. He tries pleasures of all kinds. He tries wise living. He tries hard work. And he comes to the same conclusion that all of it is pretty much meaningless. He wanted to know if there was purpose in this world. And even with all of his wisdom, he's frustrated because it gave him no clear answers. And even as he learned more, it brought sorrow because it did not provide understanding. The more he understood, the more he did not know. And from this, we could probably conclude, and maybe some have, maybe a large number of people have, that this is pretty much a worthless book. Why would you dwell on this in any way, shape, or form? I'm having a bad day. Let's read the book of Ecclesiastes. That certainly should help. No, we probably wouldn't do that. But I believe that this book, even though it is sometimes considered worthless and without hope, or even quite contradictory to the rest of the Bible, what the preacher is doing is he's writing for the sake of expressing his despair in order to make a point that only reinforces what the rest of the Bible is trying to tell us. He's coming at it from a different approach, but he's saying the same thing as the rest of Scripture. He's pointing out that we need to be disillusioned with the offerings of this life in order to have what is greater. We are to see the emptiness of life without God in order to stop seeking satisfaction in this life rather than in God. So he comes to us with this understanding, and the passage and the book has a main message that it wants to portray. And you find as you read through the book of Ecclesiastes that two key phrases or words come over and over again before us. The first is the word vanity. 34 times in the English Standard Version, the word vanity is used. Vanity or vanity of vanities. And what this word literally means is it means breath or vapor or mist or smoke. But instead of translating it as mist or vapor or breath or smoke, the interpreters or the translators of the Bible have translated it as vanity. If you use the NIV, the New International Version, it uses the word meaningless. And that's a good way to understand it. That what he's going to talk about here in over 34 times is that there's aspects of life that are like a fog. They're like the mist. They have no substance and they have no meaning. In chapter 1, verse 2, it declares that this entire life is meaningless. He goes on to explain in 12 chapters the futility of this life. He talks about work in chapter 1, verse 3. He talks about life in chapter 1, verse 4. He talks about the natural events that occur around us in verses 5 to 7 of chapter 1. He talks about the meaning of this life and how it works with us in chapter 1, verse 8. He tells us that nothing changes and nothing is new in verses 9 and 10. Nothing of significance in verse 11. Life, he tells us, is a frustration in chapter 1, verse 18. Philip Reichen gave an idea when he said, there is not one single aspect of human existence that is not frustrated by futility. It's all empty, pointless, useless, and absurd. To prove a point, the preacher will take everything that people ordinarily use to give meaning or to find satisfaction in life and then show how empty it really is. And in doing this, he will speak from experience because he's tried everything. He's tried the money, he's tried the pleasure, he's tried the knowledge, he's tried the power. What's interesting is that if you turn ahead in your Bibles to Romans chapter 5 or chapter 8 verse 20, it says that all of creation has come and or been subjected to futility. The word futility has the same understanding as what he's using here in Ecclesiastes as vanity or meaninglessness. That's where the world has come. And so we see this is what creation is under and what life is under. The second phrase that he uses here, and he uses it 28 times, is this phrase, under the sun. Or you could understand it as on the earth. This is repeated over and over again to remind us that as the author of Ecclesiastes speaks, we are to look at things from a perspective that sets our minds, our thinking, as to things under the sun or things on the earth. It gives us the context to know what he is saying. He is saying that if we look at life merely from a human or earthly perspective, it all seems meaningless. In chapter 1, verse 3, he says, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What is the profit in this life? What becomes of all of our hard work? And it's basically a rhetorical question that has only one answer. The answer is nothing. If all we are doing is just doing things so that we can have some benefit out of this life for our life, it is nothing but a fog that cannot be grasped and held on to. If our perspective is all about life now and here, then what we're going to find is emptiness and joylessness. He illustrates this by listing a series of things, and he's going to expound on them more, that go nowhere and they gain nothing. He gives examples of the natural world in verses 4 to 7 of chapter 1. And then he uses examples of from human experience in verses 8 to 11 of chapter 1. Now, without getting ahead, what he's telling us is that really in life there is no progress. There is nothing new. Everything's just the same. Everything is old. And as we'll see, all of existence, though, is not vanity or meaninglessness. It is the things of this world that will never give true meaning or lasting happiness. Well, as we've said, many have viewed Ecclesiastes as a depressing kind of book, pessimistic in its outlook, and that even the author is really just a cynic. Gerhard von Rad described Koheleth as this. He said, he's suspended over the abyss of despair, and nothing remained for Ecclesiastes but to submit in deep resignation to this tragic existence. Isn't that hopeful and helpful? But the preacher, I believe, is not an agnostic. He is not an atheist. He still believes in God. But perhaps he's a little more of a realist than we are comfortable with. Now, we would like to think that our existence on this earth, that our purpose on this earth, that our life on this earth, and even all the things that we do, all the pleasures that we seek, all the meaning and the purposes that we have in our lives, that even without, you know, an entirely a consideration of God, there's supposed to be something good that comes out of it. And what Ecclesiastes wants to do is completely drain us of every single bit of hope of such an idea. He is looking for meaning. He is looking for joy. But first, what has to happen is that we have to see the emptiness of this life without God. This life can be filled with satisfaction only when we see the vanity of this life absent from God. We can enjoy this life when we do so from the perspective of not finding joy in this world, but joy from God in this world. So this is a book filled with life. It is a book filled with what we would call our most fulfilling life. But it does so by showing us the despair of this life. So on a grander view, as we look at this book, because I believe that all of Scripture is pointing towards our salvation, it's pointing towards Christ, that is where this book is as well. It shows us our need for the gospel. That this life is filled with sin, and even as we pursue good in and of ourselves, we can do so only if we pursue Christ. We cannot do so without God. And if we try to, it is nothing but a great tragic error. So Jesus entered this world. He saw the futility, and he saw the meaninglessness. He saw the corruption. And he died upon the cross to restore, to make right that which had gone so very wrong, to give meaning out of vanity. And the entire view of the book of Ecclesiastes is to tell us to turn to God. It tells us to fear him and to live and find our life in him. It is a call to look to the author and the perfecter of our faith, Jesus Christ, for eternal, fulfilling meaning. So as we look at Ecclesiastes 1, 1-18 this morning, in brief, what it does is it forms, these verses form a bit of all that Koheleth is going to say in the rest of this book. So when we look and draw our attention to chapter 1, verses 4 to 7, what we see in 4 to 7 is that there is nothing to gain when we look at this world. He says, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. What we observe when we look at verse 4 is that the cycle of human existence does not appear to change or to make any progress. Our current humanity likes to think that we've had some great impacts upon this world, and certainly in certain aspects we have. We have developed all kinds of medicine and technology and transportation and infrastructure and all these kind of things. But some also look at it from the other side. We've also been destroying our earth and hurting it and harming it. There's that negativity along with it. But we'd like to think that we've created more creature comforts and more technology, and we're better off than we were before. And maybe in some respects we can say that. But in some of the most important areas of life, we haven't. So for example, Socrates wrote about the disrespectfulness of children back when he was living. Nothing has changed. It's still the same. We sometimes think it's gotten worse, but if you read what he says, it sounds horrible. Just as bad as today. It's not new. The problems of 4,000 years ago are the problems of today. And he talks about this. He says, people come and people go. The generations come and the generations go. People are born, people die. In this continual cycle of life, and yet the world keeps revolving around the sun without a single thought of us. We seem inconsequential. When you look at verse 5, he tells us that time keeps ticking and returning us to the very same place we were before. Now we know that the sun and time are connected on this 24-hour schedule. The sun rises and the sun sets. The hands of a clock tick and they talk, always ending up where they started before. Another day gone and another day to come. Now, this can be weariness. In fact, the word in verse 5 that talks about the sun hastening back to its starting point, literally in Hebrew, the word is gasp or pant. So it's like the sun has gone and it's gone through its circuit in the sky and it dips below the horizon and we don't see it anymore from a human perspective. And then it runs frantically to the other side just to start again, and it gets there, you know, breathing very, very hard as it tries to get ready for its next cycle through the sky. It's out of breath. It's on this monotony, this pointless track that goes on and on forever and ever, day after day. Kind of reminds me of when we lived in California, and I always laughed and joked about the pointlessness of the weatherman. Because what's it going to be today? Sunny and clear. What's it going to be tomorrow? Sunny and clear. And that's how it was for like 355, almost every day of the year was exactly the same. Sunny and clear, sunny and clear. But he didn't put on a good show. At least he tried. What's the point? Now, we often regard nature as a source of encouragement. We look at the mountains, we look at the sunsets, we look at the sunrises, and we think they're beautiful and a testimony of God's goodness. And certainly we do believe that. But as the preacher is talking right now, all he sees in this is a monotony in a static universe. But when we look at verses 6 to 7, he tells us that the natural patterns take place, but everything is no different. He talks about the wind blowing. Now we have our different patterns. Often if we see weather coming our way, where is it coming from? It's coming from the west, either the northwest or the southwest. In Palestine, if you lived in that time, often the winds would come from the north or from the south. But the point is really the same. It never ends. It doesn't really have a destination. It just keeps going and swirling around and coming around again. He talks about the streams running into the sea. But the seas are not ever full. The rivers keep flowing. The oceans keep taking it in. If you lived in that time or had an opportunity to visit that area in Israel, the Dead Sea is a prominent mass of water in the middle of the country, and it's landlocked. And the Jordan River flows into the Dead Sea, and yet the Dead Sea never overflows. Life is similar. We work for years only to have what we have earned slip through our fingers. We buy something only to have it be placed and thrown in the garbage one day and go into a landfill. It reminds me of me trying to keep my car clean in the middle of winter. You know, go wash it, and then it snows and slush and salt, and then wash it and snow and slush and salt, and do that over and over and over again. Or if you take care of the house, you make a meal, you do the dishes. People eat the food. It takes about 10 minutes to eat what you took an hour to prepare. And then you start the cycle all over again. Or if you clean your house, you clean your house, and then some people come through it and mess it all up, and then you clean it again, and you do that repeatedly over and over and over again. What a pointless thing! Clean, wash, rinse, repeat. It's all that we do. So he tells us there's this futility in the natural world. Well, he goes on in verses 8 to 11, to tell us that there is nothing to gain when we look at our life experiences. He says this, "All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, 'See, this is new'? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after." So he tells us in verse 8, when he talks about our life experiences, is that our senses are never satisfied. Now, there's probably nothing more exhausting than working hard and not getting anywhere. It's like being on a treadmill. You keep moving, but not moving, right? You keep pedaling, you keep turning, you keep running, and the scenery never changes. You're in the exact same spot you were before. And he says, look at what you hear and look at what you see. These things are never satisfied. You watch a movie. Okay, I'm good. I'm good for the next 15 years. Don't need to watch another movie. That's all taken care of. But no, we need to watch another one. We need to go see the next one that comes out. And this becomes an issue often with the lust of the eyes. We look at something that's inappropriate for us, and then we go, okay, well, that should be enough. But no, it keeps coming up again. We need more of it. We want to do it again because it's never satisfied. Then he talks about what we hear. So maybe you like music, and so you listen to a song. It's not as if any of us have ever said, okay, I've listened to one song, I'm good for the rest of my life. No, we listen to the songs on that CD or that album, and then we want another one, and we want more music. Or if you like a particular artist, and you listen to that piece of music over and over again, well, when are they coming out with something new? I want to listen to more. Because it's never satisfied. Look at our internet age. You could spend, maybe you've caught yourself, if you have the new iPhone, it kind of tells you, or the new updated OS, it tells you how much time you spent online. That's not a very encouraging thing sometimes. We spend all this time on our computers, on the internet, and what do we do the next day? We spend more time on it because we didn't get enough of what we had previously. With all the sights and sounds, it persists and it grows, and we're never satisfied with what we have. So we live in this life of sensory experiences of Netflix and Instagram and Facebook and gaming and iTunes, and we're still on the same treadmill in the same place we were before. Nothing has changed. Our senses are never satisfied. When we look at verses 9 and 10, he tells us that history has nothing new to offer. When we examine history, we can come to the same understanding that here nothing is gained. We have not advanced in any way. Wars are still going on, as they were then, they are now. They're still being fought. They come and they go. Governments rise. What do the politicians do? They make us all kinds of promises. And then what do? Inevitably, in almost every single case, break their promises. And then we re-elect a new government thinking, oh, they'll be different this time. And you know what? It's the same thing over and over and over again. But we might want to be optimistic. Okay, so let's just put on an optimistic hat for a moment. And we could say, well, what about all the advances in technology? Those have been real changes. No. You take, for instance, transportation. At one time, everyone walked everywhere. And then they got on a horse and they rode it. And then they had a carriage and they did that. And then they had a steam engine. And then they had trains. But you know what? The point is still the same. You're still trying to get from point A to point B. You're just doing it faster and a little bit differently and less work. But the experience is the same. Despite the inventions and the innovations, the nature of people is still the same as it was. We still live in this world that is as fallen as ever. If you're in a family, if you're a parent, have you not at one point caught yourself saying the very same things to your child that your parents said to you? So we can take an example. Way back, maybe one day there was a point in history where some father said to his son, "Stop staring at the clouds and pay attention to the herds. Take care of the flocks." Is that really any different than get off your iPad and clean your room? Nothing. It's exactly the same thing. So he says, history has nothing new to offer. In verse 11, he tells us that all that has been done is going to be forgotten. So for all of you sports fans, we have a few here I know, who won the World Series in 1997 without Googling it? Oh, very good. We do have someone that knows it. Okay, smarty pants, who won the Grey Cup in 1997? Aha, there we go. Who won the Stanley Cup in 1997? Well, I know because I Googled it. But for most of us, we don't have a clue because we don't remember. It is the Florida Marlins, it was the Toronto Argonauts, and it was the Detroit Red Wings who won the Stanley Cup. And the preacher here is pointing out to a reality. We think that things are so significant, that things are so mind-boggling, that things are so wonderful, only to realize that if we give it a few years, no one remembers what happened. We can experience amazing things, and then years later, we can hardly recall them. I remember being on some amazing trips. I remember years ago going on a mission trip that I talked about and was just, I says, I'll never forget some of these things. I've forgotten almost all of them. And so I think it gives good understanding to us that we can go through all these things and they can be lost forever. So in one respect, ladies, or maybe men, don't be so hard on your spouse when they forget an anniversary or birthday. It's in the Bible. It's what's going to happen. But in a more sobering aspect, we look at the frailty of humanity. As we age, we can forget. Maybe we go through dementia and we can't remember things from just a moment ago. It's a truth that the former things are forgotten while we live in a fallen world. And what is even more sobering is that each one of us will one day be forgotten when we look at things under the sun. When we move on to verse 12 to 18, he tells us more. He tells us that there is nothing to gain from what we know. So we've looked at there's nothing to gain from this, from the natural world. There's nothing to gain from our experience. And then he tells us that there's nothing to be gained from what we know. He says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So he tells us in verses 12 to 15 that we can sincerely seek out the truth and come up short. Solomon has been granted wisdom from God that has surpassed all that has been before him. He has a special spiritual gift of wisdom, and he has dedicated himself to understanding the truth of this earthly existence. He has studied nature and humanity and pleasure and work and a number of other things, and he has found all of it to be pointless. Perhaps because he could not know everything that he could know, or because the knowledge didn't really change anything. So I know a lot more than I did a while ago. Did it really matter? I think about this in my own life. When I was in high school, I had decided that I would take all of the courses that would prepare me for university. I didn't know quite what I wanted to take, but I did that. And back in my day, we had two tracks. Either you had the 101 or the 100. And the 100 was for those going to university. And so I took university entrance math and English. I took biology, chemistry, and physics. And in particularly in the sciences, I went on to use virtually none of it. There has been no practical application in my life for dissecting a baby pig. Not one. I have not found a particular good use for calculating wavelengths of a viscous fluid or the practical applications of memorizing the entire periodic table. I haven't. Now, many of you do because your jobs and careers use that kind of stuff all the time. But for me, useless. And maybe you feel the same thing. Art was a pointless endeavor. Music? What do I need that for? English class? No, I got nothing out of reading Emily Bronte. Nothing. So what I learned in this world outside of the revelation of God has not made any changes. I have not gained anything. It is vanity and striving after wind. Leonard Wolfe wrote something like 20 books, and he said this about his long life of work. He says, I must have, in a long life, ground through between 150,000 and 200,000 hours of perfectly useless work. We can seek all kinds of knowledge and come up short. In verses 16 to 18, he tells us that the pursuit of knowing the truth will drive us crazy. The preacher says again that he has gained understanding. He knew a lot of things. He was wiser than anyone before him, and it did not lead him to anything. He even studied that which we might call madness and folly. Some interpreters think that what he did is he studied things that no one of us should study. And when he says study, it's not just about him making empirical observations. It's not just about him studying from a book. He went out and participated in these things, and he enjoyed or participated in what we might call folly, what we might call things that we should not, and madness, things that maybe shouldn't be good for us. And he does this in one sense to make sure that he has not missed out on anything. He has left no stone unturned. And the result of it all, he says, is frustration and sorrow. Why? Because it's kind of like the notion, the more I came to know, the more I realized how much I did not know or how ignorant I really was. But it's also the realization that the answers to life and to meaning could not be found under the sun. You can work your entire life. Perhaps you learn a skill, and you learn that skill to perfection. And only after you have gone through all of that, you find out that not a single person on the entire face of this earth has any need for it. This is a vexation, as he says, and a sorrow, a striving after wind. So I think we'll end right there. No, we'll go a little longer because I want to answer the question, is there any hope? Now, if you are an eternal optimist, if you're the kind of person that gets up in the morning and says, oh, what a beautiful morning, I'm so happy. You morning people, you eternal optimists, you can turn around and leave the room. This is not for you. No. So you could be fighting it, right? He says, I don't like this. It's negative. But the pessimist is saying, if you're one of those who looks at the glass half empty, you're not a morning person, you're barely an afternoon person, you might say, finally, a book that I can wrap my head around. I think there is something for what the preacher is telling us here. If we take a close look, what he is saying actually makes a lot of sense. We are but a tiny speck of dust in a vast universe that has no bearing or meaning in the grand scheme of things. So is there any hope? I believe that Ecclesiastes will tell us there is. But in the immediate, we only get a clue. In verses 3, in verses 9, and in verses 14, is that repeated phrase that I said was so important, which is under the sun. And it gives us that small light of context in the dismal negativity. If our perspective is only from this world, this is what we're going to get. We are going to get striving after wind. We are going to get vanity of vanities. We're going to get meaninglessness if that is our perspective. But if we look above the sun, if we look past the clouds, if we look past the sun, we come to a hopeful understanding. If we put a spin on what he is saying, because all of this negativity points us, it directs us to look to God who dwells above the sun and to not expect nor find our meaning or fulfillment in earthly things. Charles Bridges wrote, who was a 19th century author, he says, "We are permitted to taste the bitter wormwood of earthly streams in order that standing by the heavenly fountain, we may point our fellow sinners to the world of vanity we have left and to the surpassing glory and delights of the world we have newly found." We taste a bit of the disaster in order to appreciate the greater. We do not understand the magnitude of the grace of God until we understand the depravity of our sin. Often we need to see the negative in order to see the glory. You don't appreciate the mountains as much as when you live in the prairies all your life. And so sometimes we need to be pointed to how terrible it is in order to show us what is greater. And so that is the point. But it's also this dreary speech, if we want to call it that, this dreary speech calls us to look with heavenly-minded eyes at this world and our experience of it. It calls us to look at the natural world as a declaration of God's glory. It calls us to see the cycles of life and nature as the consistency and the orderliness of God. It calls us out of the understanding that nothing is new, and perhaps nothing is really new under the sun, but what God is doing a new thing in so many ways. He has created a new covenant through Christ. He has given us a new heart of understanding, and he brings us to a new creation that one day will be our home. It calls us to seek to know God who is our life, who is the one who brings life to our souls, to seek him. See, what we want is we want something to come out of what we do. We want something to come out of our experiences. We want it to be profitable. But Solomon puts it this way in chapter 1, verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? It's a good question. As valid then as it is today, why do I put all the work that I do in this life? It's a question that Jesus asked in Matthew 16:26 when he said, "What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul?" The answer, of course, is nothing. But if we look above the sun, if we look to God, we gain eternal life. We gain joy. We gain satisfaction and the fulfilling life that this world offers but has always failed to deliver. Let us pray.